We'll move now, I think, to a kind of more general Q&A session. We've got a number of questions coming in from the audience here. I'm pretty sure we're not going to be able to get to all of them, but those of you listening, please be assured that we will forward these to the presenters and give them a chance to possibly respond to those after the fact. But to get started, we have a question here. Maybe Dr. Eplin could take this one. Is in terms of an overarching kind of policy level question, do you think there's enough marginal land to grow a significant quantity of biomass to actually affect energy demand in the U.S. Through the production of biofuels?
Well, that's an excellent question. Some of you may be familiar, several years ago, a group released what became known as the Billion Ton Study, and what they concluded or they proposed or found was that about 55 million acres of U.S. land that is currently either idle cropland or cropland pasture or very marginal cropland could be ceded to a dedicated perennial crop such as switchgrass. And so they argued that that was something that was doable. Now, most of that land is not very productive. And so we're talking about some of the land is, as it is by definition, marginal. So it wouldn't produce a great deal. But they concluded that about a quarter of the energy content of what we import of crude oil could be offset by that by those 55 million acres, and also by using judicious use of corn stover and wheat straw.
Okay. Dr. Gustafson, another question for you, it looks like. A question about whether or not the estimate was used previously for water needed to produce a gallon of ethanol is something in the range of about 4 to 6 gallons per gallon of ethanol. Is that still a reasonable number to figure on these days?
The ethanol industry is making great strides with respect to development of new technologies and productivity. Their energy balance is increasing. Water use is now falling for the new plants. The new plants now are targeting roughly 3 gallons of water per gallon of ethanol. We're working on a project here for an advanced biofuel using energy beets where it's actually be about 1 gallon. You have 1 gallon of water required to produce 1 gallon of biofuel. That's achieved, though, because the energy beets coming in are high in water. So I think the technology continues to evolve, and we're going to continue to lower the burden with respect to resources needed to produce our renewable fuels in the future.
Okay, that's a significant change then, so thank you for that. Another member of the audience is wondering whether we might be better off to consider burning biomass for electrical power generation as opposed to converting it to biofuels. Do either of you have some insights on that?
That was actually our first study for the combined heat power facility. They were looking to use wheat straw or other stovers within the region to mix with coal to generate renewable electricity. We quickly found out that they were expensive to transport, as we're finding out in our other studies. But in addition, it's not very cost effective just to burn the product. What the industry is gravitating towards is to try to pull out some either high-value fuels or even better, high-value chemicals from the process and then burn the residual with other feedstocks to develop renewable electricity. So at the moment, it's not very cost-effective just to mix and burn unless there's a requirement or mandate in the state for renewable, a certain portion has to come from renewable sources.
So thank you for that. I think this question would be best directed to Dr. Eplin's, wondering whether or not the nutrient and or soil conservation value of the corn stover or other crop residues is being fully accounted for in the equation when we start looking at growing biofuels for biofuel production, biomass, I guess, for biofuel production.
I think I'd pass that off to Cole. We don't have a lot of corn stover down here.
Okay. coal?
Well, obviously, that's based on my comments. We're starting to look at that, but I think it becomes a formula, part of the formula, when we look at expansion of biofuel industry across our nation, is that we need to look at these additional impacts to our resource base and environment.
Okay, another kind of a general policy sort of question, wondering whether or not the Department of Energy or USDA is likely to start shifting research and development dollars in the near future toward addressing this kind of infrastructure problems that you all both have identified in this morning's presentation. Either of you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I think the answer to that is that they have invested in, they have several projects ongoing and where they have funded projects not only in feedstock development, but also in feedstock harvest, in feedstock transportation, feedstock storage issues, and so they have funded projects to address the logistics of moving the material from the field to the biorefinery.
I would just add, John, that I think they have, you know, invested heavily in R&D, but there's a gap right now that exists between R&D and commercialization, and I think that is leading to quite a bit of public discussion about USDA lending programs, DOE lending programs, and some of the initial risk capital that needs to be available to foster greater development of these projects.
Yeah, and certainly you have mentioned some other gaps in your presentation this morning regarding the practicality of it, too, and whether or not it's really a reasonable kind of a thing for a producer to consider given other alternatives. Along that line, we have another question, and I don't know which one of you would be best to answer this particular one, but a person is wondering whether or not one of these energy crops, given the current markets and so on, would be a better rotational crop as compared to the traditional corn-soybean rotation versus wheat. And just kind of wondering what your thoughts might be on that.
Well, this is Cole. I'm again working on an energy beet project that looks like it's just going to have wonderful agronomic benefits for rotational crops in our area. Particularly, it's a crop that's going to work well in saline soils, which are becoming quite problematic. So I think there are some opportunities for enhanced rotational opportunities for some of these energy crops, but not all of them. There's some of them that have been mentioned that I don't think are going to be particularly well suited for this region. So I think it's going to be very much site-specific.
Okay. Another question here is kind of an overarching question maybe for Dr. Eplin is wondering what you think the outcome might be for ethanol use if there really was no blend wall, as you mentioned in your comments, and you know what the level of production might actually be if there weren't some of those regulatory hurdles or boundaries to influence a production decision?
Well, I'm not sure that I fully understand the question, and maybe we can try and get this clarified. But the mandate requires the retailers of the gasoline to use the ethanol. And there were no blend wall, and then that also the question would be, are we talking about no blend wall with a mandate or without a mandate? If you remove the wall, and in other words, the moving it to E15 means that we could increase the theoretical blend wall. What we've done, what EPA has done, by increasing the waiver to allow for the 2001 vehicles to use E15, has increased the theoretical blend wall to about 17 to 18 billion gallons. Now, that means that's if all of those automobiles used the E15 and had access to it. Probably the one question that we have is if we're going trying to go to the 15 plus the 16 or the 31 billion gallons of ethanol, then that means we would have to increase substantially the number of E85 vehicles. And it seems like there would be an opportunity for the companies that are in the business of producing corn ethanol to also get into the business of merchandising E85. And I'm not sure to what extent they've done that, but if they made that available, and it probably would be required to make that available if we're going to find a market for the 15 plus the 16 or the 31 billion gallons of ethanol. I don't know what the outcome would be if there were no blend wall, if there was no mandate to use the ethanol, and if ethanol is more costly than crude oil, then the ethanol use would probably decline. But if it is more economical, then it would be the demand for the product or the quantity used would increase.
Right. Okay, well, thank you for kind of helping us to better understand that situation a little better. I think one final question we'd like to address here is a question regarding the handling of some of these biomass products. This questioner points out that Prime Board Incorporated is a particle board manufacturer and is wondering whether or not either of you have gotten any insights or have any direct knowledge from their experience in handling wheat straw for that type of industrial process.
That was the company that I had spoke about initially in my presentation, where we had those large four piles of hay. We visited with several people that are knowledgeable of their operations. They provided some insights in terms of the strategic plan that they have for acquiring and moving feedstock. But again, it's not adaptable because of the scale of some of these other biorefineries are so much larger. So even though it might work in a micro sense, when we look at the volumes of materials, it takes a little bit different business model to accomplish that.
Okay. Well, thank you for your insights. We still have a number of questions, and we'll get those to you follow up here. But in order to close on a timely basis, we better move to our closing comments. Again, very much want to thank both of you for taking the opportunity to be with us and spending time with presenting your thoughts as well as your willingness to address the many questions we've received. I'm really confident that the audience participating today has really benefited from your insights. Another chance here to kind of plug your membership. If you folks listening in this today are not members of the AAEA or the Extension Section, we would really like to invite you to join by following one of the URLs on the screen. I know I've personally found the participation in the association as well as the Extension Section to be of great benefit to my career, and I know in talking with many of my colleagues across the country, they feel similarly. So I would encourage you to think about that. If you have any ideas or suggestions for future webinar topics that we might consider, we'd very much invite you to share those with us via the chat window, or if you have any other feedback you'd like to provide to us regarding today's webinar, we welcome those again by the chat window, or we'd encourage you to contact one of the members of the Extension Section leadership, which are listed on the AAEA website. Speaker slides for today's presentation will be made available on the Extension Section web pages at the UR listed on your screen, and as well as, I think it's been mentioned as we've gone along, but we plan to post a link for the recorded version of this webinar at that site as well as soon as we can get that prepared. So in closing, let me again extend thanks to both of today's speakers for their excellent presentation on the economics of biofuels. I very much want to thank also the Western Extension Committee's Ag and Uncertain Times team and Montana State University for making this webinar possible. We'd also very much like to thank all the participants in today's webinar. We sincerely hope that you find today's content of value in your work, and we hope to see you again on one of our upcoming programs. Until then, we offer you our sincere hope for success in meeting the challenges of today's agriculture. For the Agricultural and Applied Economics Association Extension Section, I'm John Hewlett.